Thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
You guys,
thanks for coming.
The last minute guys, kind of.
Yeah, it is kind of last minute.
Let you know I was here, but
it's okay. Some of the last minute ones end up being the best ones. For people out there listening, give me sort of like a brief background on who you are and where you came from.
So I'm Ed Lattimore. I write a lot of material. I say my motto on my website and for all the content I create is I take what I learned the hard way and I break it down so you can learn it the easy way. Mm-hmm. And some of the things I learned via, you know, the hard way, moderation and self-control, dealing with my alcoholism, I have a lot of articles about dealing with that, becoming sober and socializing, some of the things you'll have to face and deal with the demons that you may not be prepared to deal with.
Yeah.
I'll write a lot about just improving yourself in general. I also write about growing on social media. We were just talking about the whole SEO idea. And to me, it seems like a really intuitive and automatic kind of thing. Like, okay, if I say a thing and I capture this attention, then how do I make it grow? And I'm really big on doing it without being a troll. Like, I don't talk about politics. I don't put people down. I don't try to put any negativity out in the world. I'm a firm believer in if you deliver value via entertainment or education, that people will come and find you. However, you have to have done the work to be a valuable person. So people don't just go, oh, this is another guy spouting off timeless wisdom. Like, no.
Yeah. It's very oversaturated on social media right now with people, you know, being gurus of this, that, and the third.
Absolutely.
Freaking entrepreneurial gurus, Gary V's, all those guys. There's just so many of them.
Everyone wants to do it because they just see these guys saying these things and they forget. Like, I'm not like 100% familiar with like Gary V's story, but I know that Gary V didn't wake up one day and go, I want to spout off a bunch of things and make money. He was like, no, he went and made money first, and then came and said, okay, here's some lessons to take from it, and decided that was another cool place he wants to be. And I think that's just a natural extension of any type of hard work that a person does. They end up there one way or the other because after you have done some things, you get enough questions about said things, and some people are motivated to teach in one way or the other, whether it be one-on-one or to a group. There's always some way you want to distribute value, redistribute value, I should say, to people who you believe, you know, kind of helped you come up. But that's me on my website.
Okay.
And a lot of things that I did outside of that beforehand is we talked about, you know, how you gain this ability to say stuff that people listen to and take seriously. I boxed professionally for 6 years, amateur for 5 before that.
Wow.
I had a great, great time, great career, especially as an amateur. I went further than I thought I would go as an amateur because I started late. I didn't walk into a gym until I was 22, which is ancient, but the advantage
for boxing, that's ancient, right?
That's dinosaur. But the advantage is that I'm a heavyweight, and what people have to understand is if you start boxing when you're a kid and you just keep at it with the training and everything, you're probably not probably me you just unless you're like 6'6" or taller, you're not gonna put the mass on naturally. So I was off doing other sports and getting stronger, and I decided to go box. I mean, you look at the top guys, Deontay Wilder's older. I started older than me at that, too. I believe that so is Joshua. There's another guy out there. I can't remember his name right now. Don't come to me. But a lot of guys at the heavier weight divisions, they not only start later, but then they can last longer. One of my favorite guys that I watch who's, you know, recently is a guy named Amir Mansour. Amir Mansour was killing guys, right?
In
the ring, just dropping them. And then, unfortunately, Amir was out there doing some crimes and got pinched, I believe, in something related to drugs.
Yeah.
And went away for 10 years. Didn't get out because I'm looking at his box rec where you can see everyone's record. I'm like, man, what happened to Amir? 10 years out, comes right back out at 37 and starts killing it. Fought till he was 45.
Really?
And did a great job. It was, I mean, the only fights I saw him rightfully lose, maybe one. He lost one fight that would have got him a title shot because he bit through his tongue and just couldn't continue.
That
kind of thing was awful. But yeah, when you start heavyweight boxing, you can go a little later. But I didn't have any like natural athletic ability, I think, and I went really far with that. I had a great time, and then I got my success as an amateur helped me move well as a pro until, you know, I went as far as I could at the time. And also while I was doing that, I was enlisted in the Army because I figured I don't have any skills outside of boxing. Like, I had just been, you know, I've been spending the past decade beating up people and not really gaining anything. And I know I can't beat up people forever. Not only that, but there's not that much money in the sport. People think we're getting paid. I mean, my highest payday was not even five figures. Like, to put that in perspective, and that's standard. I think Carl Froch, he's a champion. He did some research on this and put it together. And he said that 97% of fighters are going to have to get a job.
Really?
After they quit. Like, and not just like, oh, they're not doing anything. They know you got to get it. There's no unions. No one cares about the fighter. It's very much a gladiator kind of bottom of the barrel sport. A lot of gyms are in poor neighborhoods, and that is not a coincidence. It's cheap. I mean, what do you need? You need gloves and aggression. I mean, a ring is optional, especially when you're coming up as an amateur. You know, you compete in one, but I've been to some gyms where, like, quite literally, it's in a corner of a warehouse, and someone took and used those two walls. The corner is two sides of the square, and the other two, they put some rope around, and that was all they had. So that you see that a lot in the sport, and I had an experience, this one experience. I was walking from the gym when I was an amateur, and for whatever reason, I left my phone and my iPod at home. And that kept me looking forward, so I could see when somebody's car came up and lost control off the sidewalk, and I jumped out the way, and I was like, huh, that was close. I could lose boxing at any time. Let me do something else with my life and start building that up. Plus, there was just the pain points and everything. So, you know, I went and got my degree in physics while I was busy being a pro and enlisted in the military. And I chose physics for lots of other reasons.
Yeah, why physics?
That wasn't the original goal. The original goal was math. And I chose math because I thought that I was going to have to go to school, or I thought I was going to have to work while I was boxing and go to school. Right. So I'm already planning to be super busy. And what ends up happening is I go to the military. And the reason I figure I'm busy is because there are going to be lab sciences and any other sciences. And I looked at, like, where all the high paying jobs were, and they all needed math. So I said, okay, you got to learn math. That's just what's got to happen. I go, and in my military, my occupational specialty, my MOS for the military was 94 Alpha, and that means I had to go do a lot of work with electronics. Mm. And as part of my training, I went through this thing called BMAT in Fort Lee, Basic Mechanical and Electronic Theory. And I was like, oh, this is even cooler. I think I want to be an electrical engineer. And all the engineers have to take physics. And so I take physics when I start class. And my first physics class, you got to do this thing with projectile motion. You got to predict where a pellet is going to land with no other forces acting on it but gravity and the initial, like, acceleration.
Right.
And it landed where I said it was going to land. And I said, yo, that's like magic. I want to do that instead. And so that's how I ended up there. I mean,
crazy.
I stuck with it because I don't really understand the idea of quitting. I understand being beat out of something. That's how I approached boxing. I said, I'm going to go as long as I can. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to have to tell me I suck, or I'm going to have to get injured.
Okay.
And what ended up happening is I got injured as a pro. And then my coach was like, dude, he's like, man, you're doing all this stuff. Your life is great. Why are you still here? Like, do you understand that every time you walk in the ring, you have a chance of being permanently altered in a way that can alter your life and not in a positive direction? Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't say it exactly like that, but that's kind of how I filtered it. Mm-hmm. Basically, he's like, you know, I'm your friend. I care about you. You don't need to do this anymore. And so I walked away from that and really put a lot more energy into my website and into my writing and things, and my chess game too, which is
your chess game.
Yeah. I started competing in chess this year.
That's sick.
What?
I love chess. Right?
We need to get a chess table here.
I know, we should have one.
I love playing chess. I suck so bad.
Oh, man. You know what? I was progressing from, you know, where I was to where I am now.
Yeah.
I really wanted to take it seriously. I'd always kind of just been playing on chess.com. So I said, okay, if I want to talk about chess on social media, and I'm always going to say how much I love it, then I have to go and start competing OTB over the board. So I started registering tournaments and working on my game. And then that led to me getting a coach who found out, and he is a great coach, Eric Kislik, for anybody listening who's looking for an international master. He's gained that title, and he's really I understand the game better. I told him what was wrong. And I was like, well, this is where I'm frustrated, and I don't know what to do here, and I feel lost when these things come up. And he was like, it's okay. He's got all these, because a good teacher gets used to seeing the same problems in the students over and over again. And he, in chess, it was no different. He actually had this thing drawn up. It's like, here's what you're going to do in the semi-open and open positions. Ask yourself these questions, see what it looks like here. And I'm like, and it changed my entire way of looking at the game, because before I was like, I make this move and then he makes that move. And I kind of had an idea that there was a strategy element, a planning element, but I didn't really get it. And now I see, because no one's looking far ahead. I mean, I can't remember what Grandmaster said it, but a famous quote is, I don't look 3 moves ahead. I think about the next move and I make the correct move every time. And I was like, wow, that's profound. And that's what it is, because I'm looking at the game and I'm going, okay, I see all of this stuff. What do I focus on? And Eric's work gave me a way to look at the game and go, I can focus on it. So now my chess.com ratings are all over 15. One is over 16. And that's good. Okay. That's like, you know, my 30-minute game, my 3-day game, my blitz game in 10 or 5 minutes. And it'll keep getting stronger, because I know it's not going to, you know, happen overnight. And I'll get as good as I can. Maybe my limit is like 1,800 and I'll never get a title. Or maybe I could be a GM. Yeah. I don't know. I probably can't be a GM. Those guys, man.
We used to play with this guy. There was a guy across the street from our old office in St. Petersburg. This guy, he would come and hustle me playing chess.
Larry.
His name was Larry. Shout out to Larry. And he'd make me buy him, I forgot, what did I buy him? Like
just
cigarettes?
Buy a beer.
If he beat us,
we would have to buy him a beer from the store.
If I beat you, you gotta buy me a beer. That's what it would be. And the dude, he would beat me in less than 5 minutes every time. He was like phenomenal at chess. I remember asking him, like, how do you think that far ahead? I'm like, I can't even think 2 steps ahead. And you're thinking literally like 20 steps ahead. How do you do it? And he's just like, his response was, I've done it. I've played the game so many times. I know every way it can go.
Well,
that's basically what it was. Like, I can't really think that far ahead. I've just seen this before.
You just, I don't know if he was actually doing that. I mean, we all think. A lot of times when we're successful, we have an explanation for it, and that explanation is an approximation filtered through what we know and our level of understanding of like how we learn a thing or how a thing works. So sure, he thinks he is looking ahead, but the reality is, I mean, it's just there's probably common mistakes or patterns or whatever. But chess is like, it's not the best analogy for life. I think poker or prize fighting is probably the best analogy for life, but chess is a pretty good analogy for life, or certain parts of it, because you're not necessarily able to see into the future. But what you can do is take a survey of the current landscape and go, okay, I'm weak here, I'm strong there. This is a little behind. I need to get caught up there. He's got space over there, so let me develop over here and kind of stay away from those problem areas. And then you just make the correct move over time, and eventually you get into a winning position. Now these are critical moments. They don't make themselves obvious, right? I mean, sometimes they do, but most times it's not going to be an outright, ooh, there's a checkmate. It's like, no, it's like now you have a chance to turn a possible even position into something where you have an advantage. And then from there, you can, you know, if you continue to play well, you crush the game. Yeah. Magnus Carlsen, the current world champion, says, my goal every time is to play 30 good moves. That's it.
Really?
30 good moves. Because there's that idea again of not seeing ahead. No, I'm sure like he's got tons of patterns in his mind. He kind of knows where some things go, some things won't. But that sums up this thinking, and it's a really great analogy. It's not that I'm looking 6 years ahead. I used to say when I went back to school when I was 28, I used to say, 5 years are going to pass anyway, right? Am I going to turn 33 with more options or less options? I didn't know exactly what the options were. Someone asked me yesterday at the conference. They were like, you know, did you know that you were going to be standing on this stage speaking to us? I'm like, no, I had no idea. In fact, if you want to know exactly what I was thinking, I said, okay, When I was doing that, I said the average salary for someone with physics is like 60,000, but the variance was incredible because there's so many things you can do with a physics degree. And I said, I'm going to get something interesting and I'll be doing like 80K and it's going to be a great job and I have a great life because I can finally eat whenever I want to. That's always been my goal. It's like, I just want to be able to not look at the price of the menu. Like, like not even balling either. Not like a Ruth Chris Steakhouse, man. Like, I just wanted to go out and get some Chinese food. Not think about whether my car was going to be declined or something like that. Right. That was just the initial goal. So I made the right move when I looked at all the things that were holding me back and I said, okay, well, I got pretty good discipline, pretty good communicating. I can work hard too. I mean, I will make sure I learn something, but I just keep losing time with the bottle, man. I just keep losing time being drunk all the time and hungover. So let me do something about that. And I said, okay, you know, we're going to be sober. We're going to do it out, try it out. I gave myself every possible advantage I could. I went to an AA meeting. I told my friends. I said, look, man, texted all my friends. I said, look, I love you guys, but I'm scared and I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to make anything in my life. Or maybe I hurt somebody if I keep drinking. I may be understating how bad it was. Right.
Right.
But it was bad enough to where I was worried. And I gave myself every single event. I immersed myself completely. If it wasn't school, it was the army. If it wasn't the army, it was the gym. And if it wasn't that, me and my girl was doing something. I was playing with my cats. I wouldn't let anything derail me. That was recognizing that one little weakness. Right. And then from there, I'm able to make things happen. I'm able to do work. But it's important because I didn't know I was going to write a book about sobriety, for example. I had zero idea. But that book has opened up opportunities for me. And how did it get started? Well, I had to be sober first, right?
Right, right.
And then I had to have a platform where people even cared.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. One of your talks I was listening to, like people ask me who I am. I'm just a sober guy.
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, and these things, they keep coming together. I can build the platform because I'm not out being drunk all the time, and people care about the platform because I've done other things in my life. And why can I do those other things in my life? Because, I'm not out being drunk all the time. It all comes back to just making that correct move and looking forward. You know, when I lost the fight we were talking about before the before we started, when I lost the fight, I lost all.
Scoot a little bit closer.
I lost all the money, you know, and it wasn't a lot of it, but I was dependent on it. And I entered a dilemma. The dilemma was, well, okay, I want to finish school because I wasn't done. I took time off when that happened. And I entered, I'm like, I need to go back to school, but I need to make enough money to pay my rent. And I need enough time to go to school. So I can't work full time and get a full time salary, but part time is not going to pay me anything. Tried internships. No one would give me anything despite all the credentials and the military advantage, whatever. But here I am now. What's interesting. So I was grinding for the past 2.5 years. And in that grind, I got closer to my coach and his family. And I also had my physics and math background. And so my coach's wife says, if he can tutor math and physics, we might have something for him at the university, at the high school she was a guidance counselor at. And I said, well, that's all I can tutor, man. I don't know anything else right at this point. And so at that point, I'm able to take on clients at 35, then 40, then 45, then 50. I had to start raising my price because no one else could do it.
It's the only way to scale it, yeah.
Normally, there are lots of tutors for lots of things.
Right.
But the people who can do the math and the physics, you know, most of them have jobs. So this is this weird kind of opening gap, and it's the hardest subject for kids to pick up. Mm. So everyone needs help, and then they're in the right environment to be able to afford the prices that'll, you know, keep me eating and living. But how did that start? I had an out. Now you can get yourself into a bad situation, but if you've been taking the correct steps before, it's easier to survive. Imagine if I had just been boxing, doing nothing else with my life, just partying, being a fool after every fight, and then I lose anyway. Now I ain't got that many options to recover, to go forward. Then I just go back to doing whatever. Maybe it was actually, I actually took a job, right? Because all I knew was a job, right? Yeah. This whole like working for myself thing, that experience of losing that fight, that was my baptism by fire. Like I had to learn how to make money. Like because prior to that experience, I was just used to people giving me money for my time slash service. I didn't understand the concept of value generation and value acquisition and exchange. I took a job before I started tutoring where I was delivering packages for Amazon. And every time I'm in a nice neighborhood, because that's what it was, we go to the facility, they load up the truck. We had to be at the facility by 5 a.m. And then they didn't want us on the road after sundown. And I used to think that was because they cared about us. And now I know it's just because they didn't want a lawsuit. And I'll get to why I know that just a moment. But I do this and they give me a route. They said, this is the part of the city you're in. Go for it. And it was always a really nice neighborhood. And now every time I drive through a nice neighborhood, I don't think I want to live there. I don't think, oh, this is an ambition. Like this is a driving force. I think I get cold, man, because I lost a fight in September.
Oh.
And then the money ran out and then I got the job in December because it was the holidays. Everyone they always look, man. Anyone listening, if you need a quick hustle and you're in the city, Amazon is always looking for people. There's tons of shifts because people are buying more and they're sending more stuff. They need more bodies.
Right.
And I was one of those bodies and I did that and I got, I mean, I just think cold. I'm like, woo. And I go, man, I'm so happy that I'm not there anymore. But how do I know that they just want to avoid a lawsuit and that limitation on the hours to work? How do I know that's not an altruistic thing? So I was delivering packages one day. This was my last day, by the way. I was delivering packages one day and I get out. And the car, there was a malfunction and the transmission gives and it rolls down the hill. Thank goodness it was like 6:30 in the morning and no one was outside. And it actually rolled into someone's garage, like the outer part of the garage. So everyone was all good.
Yeah.
And what did they do? They sent another driver out. I was like, oh man, they're going to rescue me. They'd be like, all right, get your packages and load them into this truck. We got to finish this route. I'm like, hold up. Y'all don't want to know if I was drinking? Like, no, no. Because that's what's supposed to happen on any type of accident involving vehicles and job. They're supposed to, you know, make sure you're not drinking and talk to you like right there. Nah, we right on the road. We start delivering stuff. And then we finish it. And this is when I was like, okay, this is unacceptable. I got to do something else. I had to just listen to this woman all day. Just you ever know, you know those people that just everything is like, I wish they would, and then they do it, and nothing happens.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing. It was like, you know, they complain about the route. She's talking about she's gonna quit this, that, the other, and I got a feeling about halfway through. I was like, this is every day. So they gave me the day off.
Okay.
The next day, and then they said, all right, you're gonna come in. That day, I was like, you know what? This is it for me, man. It was only like $11 an hour. I said, I'll figure this out. I don't know how I'm going to figure it out, but at that point, I knew I had to. So that's how you kind of get.
Was this in Pittsburgh?
This was in Pittsburgh.
Wow.
And then, you know, it my life always flashes before my eyes when I think about it. Because I think, what if I had been like right behind that van? Or what if there had been some people out? Or something like that. And I just go, you know what? I'm not going to ignore it. Like I'm a big, not a big believer, I guess. I have a moderate level of belief in the idea that there are signs from the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe those signs aren't forward acting. It's not like someone's saying, do this. And no, it's like, okay, here's what happened. You got a choice now. And if you make the right choice, this ain't going to happen again. If you make the wrong choice, not only is this probably going to happen again, but it's probably going to happen worse, or at least exact a steeper toll from you if you don't do it. Because what do they say? You know, if you don't learn a lesson, you're just going to keep getting the test over and over again until you learn the lesson.
Right.
And as long as you don't learn it, you can't graduate to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I learned the lesson.
Wow. I loved the analogy you made on that one talk that you did about the mountain climber.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be the, don't worry about being, don't be the mountain. You want to be the mountain climber.
Oh yeah.
That really inspired me. I liked that one. Yeah. Can you explain that one?
Oh, for sure. You know, I think a lot of times people let things just happen to them as opposed to making things happen. It's the whole, are you a subject or an object? Or my favorite way to put it, if you ever seen The Departed at the beginning, when Jack Nicklaus is like, everyone says, you know, you're a product of your environment, but I want my environment to be a product of me. And that, I mean, first of all, I love that movie in general.
Yeah.
But that is one of those things that just really sticks with you. Yeah. That idea that you're not a passive kind of participant or just a passive like thing in life. You're an active participant. And that was the whole idea behind the mountain versus the mountain climber. The mountain is passive. People climb the mountain. The mountain is, you know, it is what it is, man. Wherever the mountain is, he's stuck too. But the mountain climber can move. He can go up. But what's the trade-off? Is that when you climb a mountain, that's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of risk involved. You can fall. You can get lost. People die climbing mountains all the time. But when you get to the top, you've done a thing that a lot of people won't ever do. They won't even try it, many of them. They're terrified. And the ones who do try, they fail for many reasons, many of which, not all, but many of which are due to their own decisions. You know, sometimes you get unlucky, you put your foot in a cobra hole, and that's it, right? It ain't always that way, but sometimes, there you go, right?
Right.
But barring the things that you can't control, you know, when you maximize control over the things you have the ability to affect, and you get to the top of the mountain, you've done a really powerful thing for yourself and for how you see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if people do more things that are difficult or challenging, they push themselves through it. You know,
was there a time where you felt you were at the peak, you were at the summit of a mountain, and you had like, you were really riding high?
Oh yeah, you know, and
was that with boxing, or
it was with boxing, yeah. Making money online. Those are the two big examples recently.
Yeah.
And with boxing, you know, you get humbled, and you get humbled hard too.
Yeah.
You know, you don't just kind of get humbled, right?
Mm.
Everyone, you know, that negative feedback loop pushes you down quick, and it pushed me. You know, I went from being a guy who was like a social media person on there for all of my boxing and talking about stuff to a dude delivering packages with Amazon. Like,
yeah.
That is, I mean, you want to talk about humiliating. And then before that, right? Before delivering the packages, I was actually working in the warehouse.
Right.
Right? So I'm just kind of like laying low, hoping no one recognizes me. Well, they'll talk about the losers of grandeur, right? Hope no one recognizes me, right?
Yeah.
No one cares. You know, everyone's there for their own things. Not like anyone. But that is a great example of getting dragged. And you think you're doing well. You get knocked down. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to get back up. You got to figure out a way to survive. You're just going to take that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think a lot of people in that situation, and I've seen it, they take that. I was like, this is not good. And I got to get out of here. Same with, you know, I think in my, when I was in school, I was doing really well. I was doing so well. And I was so close that I said, I'm going to take 4 higher level classes at once. It's the last 4 classes I need to graduate. It was mechanics, electromagnetism, solid state physics, and thermodynamics. I took all of them at the same time. And it was killing me. And I said, okay, but I'm going to figure this out, right? Because no one ever admits to themselves how bad it is until they can't. And then some people deny it. Other people go, ooh, got to do something. Well, the reports came out and they were like, yo, you're failing all your classes, right? Teachers call, like professors that have been following me and talking to me, call me and were like, is anything okay? Is everything okay? Whatever.
Yeah.
And finally, I had to look in the mirror and go, you know what? I can't do this. Let me stop. And I went and told my advisor, and she's like, you know, when you told me you wanted to do this, I didn't think you were going to be able to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, so why'd you let me do it? She goes, well, I try to be supportive and encouraging. And now you know, and plus now we got some feedback on how another how it can work and all that. Yeah. But I got dragged and I finished it. I mean, talking about hustle and really busting my ass, but I got in there and I finished the two classes I kept with a C, and I was like, wow. That's really that drags you, because now, you know, I have those C's and I have no desire to go to grad school. But like I go, okay, humbled and dragged. You make a lot of money, and then your next sale, no one buys anything. You know, that's happened. I mean, I remember the first time I made 5 figures in a month, and I said, "Ooh, I'm the man!" Right? Let me just do this again the same way, and I try. And I barely cracked 4. And then you're like, you feel sick. You wonder what happened. You wonder what did. And then I started asking, did I get lucky or am I just bad? And you start questioning yourself. And a lot of guys, they don't maybe move forward. They don't. They don't seek outside help. I think that's like the biggest issue there too, right? Mm-hmm. Like back to the mountain climber analogy. If you're climbing a mountain, and you and your gear is busted. There's a hole in your parka, man. You about to die. You out of food. And another guy comes by looking all shiny and clean. And he's like, hey, man, do you need some help? If your pride says, no, I'm good. Meanwhile, you like bleeding out of your ass. It's just a matter of time. You know, whatever. The help was offered and you passed and now suffer. But if you go, dude, I am in bad shape. Help me. All right. And I try to do that whenever I can now, because the more times you ride high and get knocked down, and it happens no matter what, like, because I'm sure something great is going to happen again. I'm going to feel like I'm king of the world, and I'm going to get knocked down.
Yeah.
You know what the difference between now, though, when it happens as an adult with some experience with this cycle versus being a teenager, or not even teenager, just a younger adult, is that now I don't boast, brag, whatever. I just kind of go, ooh, looking kind of nice today. Let's hope this continues. And go
carry
away.
On.
But like you know, one of the things I did, you know, when I fought on TV, I went and told everybody, and then I just kept telling them over text, over social media, whatever. And then you lose in front of the whole world in a really embarrassing fashion. And that flips the script entirely, because look, if you hadn't done that, if I hadn't told everyone, realistically, no, most people wouldn't have known, right? Like, no, I would love to think everyone, you know, is tuning in, but realistically, most people wouldn't know. So I brought all that pressure on, and now it's like, oh, I gotta deal with that. I gotta deal with how I feel about it. You know, fortunately, I wrote in an article, you know, 8 things I learned losing on TV, and one of the things I said was that heaven and hell are like analogous to what happens when life is going good and life is going poorly. And when life is going poorly, you get the type of attention and energy you put out into the universe when things were going well. And if you want to be, if you want to take that even less abstract, how you treat people when you don't have to treat them well is how they're going to treat you when you are
right.
not doing well. And so, and because I'm a big guy on like support, positivity, giving back, very grateful for everything in my life, you know, I didn't have a bunch of people, you know, killing me. If you watch the social media comments after some of these guys who lose when they're real a-holes, oh man, it shows you people may act nice, but the reality is if you cross, you don't even have to cross somebody. If they don't like you and you give them reasons to dislike you, they're licking their chops for when things go wrong.
Oh yeah,
and when they go wrong, they're gonna remind you, and they're gonna and they'll never be able to forget.
Especially on social media too.
You know, and I don't bring out the haters, at least not nearly as bad as anyone else on social media. I think in terms of like controversial personalities, I'm relatively tame.
yeah.
And let me tell you, I remember when I lost, no one on Twitter really bugged me. Not that much. Every now and then someone go, oh man, your head must still be ringing from that.
When you say when you lost, did you only lose one time?
I only lost one time as a pro.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But I want to hear that story.
But professional boxing is Oh, there's so much to it. I'll jump right
you,
into
you,
it.
You, so you lost like one televised match.
Yes.
Okay.
Because, you know, that unless you, so everything is like, what have you done and why should we give you this thing?
Right.
If you've done well, we give you more things and we continue to see if you're worth it. And then eventually you get to a point where they're like, okay, well, we've invested in you. We're going to take our pound of flesh back. Right. And that's what a good contract does. A good contract should have the fighter. I hate to say it like this, but this is what it is. A good contract usually puts the fighter in a bit of an indentured servitude position.
Right.
The difference being now that the fighter can walk. Now, when the fighter walks on a contract, he can't fight for like I've seen 9 to 12 months, though they won't even let you fight anyhow.
Really?
But, oh, yeah.
Afterwards?
If you walk on a contract, yeah. Okay. Now, if your terms are up or it's like a mutual release, you know, but they a lot of times that's just put in there. If you act like a bad person, I don't know how R-rated my speech can get, but I'm just gonna keep it nice and PG-13. If you act like a really bad person, that's just a way for people to kind of protect their investment and or make your life annoying. So I got the contract, a professional contract, when I was. And I have to, we're going to break some boxing game down, right? I don't know how much you know about boxing, but everyone's going to get a nice little nice little lesson about the business end of things.
Okay.
So there are shows where fighters fight, and those shows are put on by promoters, and the fighters on those fights are managed by managers. And for a while, you used to be able to have the manager and the promoter be the same entity. No longer. That's illegal. You can't do it anymore. I don't remember what. I think it's part of the Muhammad Ali Act, but I'm not 100%.
Is there a specific reason for that?
Well, sure. It creates conflict of interest.
Okay.
For you know, sometimes that's okay. Or like if a manager. So what happens, right? So you have a manager and a promoter as acting as one entity, and he brings a fighter on. And he manages one fighter that's going to fight another fighter. And the promoter knows, right? Because how does the promoter get paid? The promoter gets paid when the tickets are sold. Mm-hmm. And the manager just gets a cut of the winnings.
Okay.
You know? So there is no reason, if you have both of those guys work together, there's no person fighting to get the highest purse for the fighter, because the promoter is always going to take a cut of the whole thing.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
So it removes the lever, and it's really to protect the fighter. I mean, the manager would love to be the promoter, right. I'm sure. Yeah. But that's really what it comes down to, is that kind of thing.
Okay.
Right? So those are three big players: the promoter who puts the fights on, the manager who gets the fighter the fight a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Or is the promoter, now they figured out some kind of ways to work around this, but we'll get to that, and the fighter.
Okay.
All right. So the fighter is always looking to get promoted by a big promoter, Top Rank, Golden Boy. Those are the two guys that come up to my head. Right now, DAZN or DAZN, if you're familiar with any of these guys. Mm. Those are the promoters. They have these big old shows. They have they're the ones that sell the tickets, put the money up, take the risk. And then the manager's like, we're trying to get you signed with a promoter, because then the promoter is like, okay, we want you on for like, you know, three shows, and we're going to make money with you and all that. And the fighter's like, all right, well, here I am, and here's a cut of my earnings. I'm the one taking all the risk. But there you go. So the better you fight and the better your resume, whether it be through amateur accomplishments like a national title or an Olympic medal or whatever, the sooner you get signed by a promoter, because everyone wants to get signed by a promoter, because the promoter, now this is changing just a little, but the promoter is the one that, one, their name is on it, and they have all the connections, like the TV dates, right? Mm. Now, TV's becoming a little obsolete because everyone's switching to apps. The Zone took a big risk, and it really paid off. They have a huge, just a huge base. $9.99 a month compared to a $100 one-time pay-per-view. And even if you only have two pay-per-views, that's you know, $200, as opposed to a $9.99 a month thing. And people don't think like that anyway, right? Even they don't break the math down and go, okay, well, it makes sense. No, all they see is it's only $9.99 a month. Of course I get this. Look, man, I've only watched like four of my DAZN like fights. But it's only $9.99 a month. I don't think about it. It just comes out of my account.
Yep.
So That's what they want to get. They want to take, because the promoter's done all that work to build this platform to have these guys come and fight. And the sooner you get that, that's everyone's goal. Because anyone can fight on a local show. That's what I did. You fight on these local shows and build up. But what's the local show limited by? Space. Mm. You can only get, I mean, what, 500 people maybe into a good venue until you start getting like MGM Grand and bigger places, which the big promoters pay for and they take the risk and put up, where you can put, you know, 10,000, 15,000 butts in the seat. And you can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I didn't get, I just had a manager when I started. And then that manager got me a deal with a promoter. And my promoter then put me on all these different shows as they're moving and developing me, somewhat acting like a manager, but not really. But because I worked with a new promoter, Rock Nation Sports, and they hadn't really, they were putting on shows, but they were in the meantime developing the fighters they signed by letting them fight on other shows.
Okay.
Because the promoter doesn't always have to let you fight on someone else's show. He's like, I paid for you. I'm trying to invest you. But they're doing that to develop on these local shows, smaller shows, bring the opponent in, pay the opponent, all that good stuff. Okay. Right? And then they have a TV date. So that's how you get on TV. Without a TV date, without a TV date or the internet now with Dazzle, you got no chance. You'll be fighting for peanuts for your entire career because there's just no way to make more money. And it's crazy when you talk to some fighters who don't understand this. What I just broke down, who don't understand this, they complain to a local promoter. I have a buddy that's a local promoter. He tells me all the time, he goes, these guys, they want more money all the time. And I'm like, well, there's very much a cap on how much money you can give them. Because they don't understand that. Mm-hmm. So that's how that goes. The manager, promoter, okay, and the fighter.
Right.
And so everyone's dream is to get a promoter with TV dates and a bigger reach or access to bigger venues, because that's where the money is, at least in America. In Europe, it's a bit different.
Yeah.
But in Europe, they're not competing with the NFL, the NHL, the MLB, and the NBA, the big four. So fighting is still... The fighting's just received better. There's more money. There are more people who watch it.
Yeah.
It's on more networks.
Way more. There.
And also, this is really awesome, too. The United States, people go, oh, man, why are we sucking boxing in the Olympics all of a sudden? Well, we're competing against countries where, one, the best athletes aren't being taken to the gridiron or the basketball court, for example. And they also pay for the coaching, the fighting systems are not the fighting system. Mm. The sports are subsidized by the government. So, you know, the story about Gennady Golovkin. He is a great fighter out of his country. I think Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan. It's one or the other. So, okay, you know, people who watch it, like,
yeah,
he's wrong. And great fighter, does all these things. I think he won a medal. I'm not sure. But he wants to go pro and he wants to fight in America. And so normally when that happens in America, a fighter stays with the same coach from amateur to professional, because that makes sense. He put that time and that investment. Right. He trained the kid when the kid quite was not even capable of earning.
Right.
He wants to stay, and now he earns and now he gets a cut. Well, not so much in these places where the coach is paid. So he's like, "Nah, I'm not leaving. I have a great thing here. Are you kidding? Yeah, I produced you.
Right.
I'm not going to pay me more now. Why would I leave?" So he's got another coach, and you know, I think his coach is the guy named Abel Sanchez out of California.
Really?
And like, Abel didn't train him as an amateur. Abel just got him when he was a pro.
Wow.
And that's why, because a lot of these guys, when out of these other countries, man, they do well because they take care of the fighters when they train. And that's really important because unlike professionals, amateurs don't earn any money, right? So they got to do something to earn money, and that something, assuming it's legal, that something takes time away from, I mean, even if it's illegal, right? Takes time away from training.
Right.
But they don't have that issue in other countries. So it's they're just walking into a very competitive situation.
Wow. I had no idea that the sport was subsidized in countries like that.
Mm-hmm. If you look, I mean, I think what the United States. Ooh,
we don't do that with any sports here, do we?
No. Well, do we? For Olympic level sports, no. But look at the way we do our football and our baseball. We don't call it subsidizing a sport. What we do is we call it a scholarship.
Okay. Right, for college football.
And you know, now the NCAA has ruled, and that, dude, I can't.
Oh, in California, right? Now they can pay college. Oh, my God.
And now Florida is proposing the same legislation.
Really?
Which is a big deal because
that's huge.
When California did it, the NCAA was like, okay, you're big, California, but we're not going to allow you to participate if you do this. And they did it. So now that's what they were doing. If Florida comes on board, now they have a hard decision because those are two really big. A lot of powerhouse schools in both places. And then after that, it's only a matter of time. Texas is probably going to follow suit.
For sure.
And then the NCAA is going to be forced to make a very big choice, but they won't need – what are you going to do? You're going to block out the big buyers or the big schools? And they're doing it in such a way that the coaches don't have to feel threatened because they're not saying you're going to pay the students. What they're saying is – they can make money off of their likeness.
Right.
And that's a really big deal.
Oh, is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the colleges aren't paying them.
They're not going to pay them. What they're going
to do, they make so much advertising money off them. It's ridiculous.
Crazy. So this is nuts, right? As an athlete, well, we're going to use football. So when I say this, anyone listening,
right.
I'm talking about NCAA football. I don't know how it works for anyone else, but I know that football brings in the most money. So this is the most football and basketball, most relevant. If you're a big-time player, you're not allowed to work, and you're not allowed to take money.
Right.
So how are you supposed to get money? What is school supposed to cover you? Okay? And that's kind of cool. But look at how much money the schools make off of a player that gets big time.
Oh, it's insane.
Even a player gets small time. I spoke at the University of South Carolina this year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they were telling me, because I just took a tour to the school. I spoke to the football team and took a tour of the facilities and everything. He was saying that, like, these guys are like rock stars because of the internet. Guys have 3 posts and 50,000 followers.
Yeah.
Because everyone just goes, because they just go and look at the website and see the roster and load them up, and then. But we're all saying the other big issue is everything comes with a price, right? Mm-hmm. The other big issue is that these guys, they can't, because they're teenagers. They don't have the discipline to be like, I'm going to ignore those comments. It's already hard enough for adults.
Some guys in the NBA still can't even hold back on it.
Right. And so you expect an 18, 19-year-old kid with all this attention to ignore that. But yeah, so that's the big deal now.
And that's what annoys me about football fans in general. They'll always complain. Like, I'm like mainly the old white guys. They'll be like, oh, these fucking guys can't keep their mouth shut. They just fucking spat. These guys are millionaires, but they're idiots. Like, dude, this guy's 20 years old.
And people forget that.
Because
we correlate a lot of a thing with time and experience.
Right.
And they have the experience.
Right.
Absolutely. And they have the time invested in such a small amount of space.
Yeah.
I mean, most people are never going to get to the point in their career where they're capable of earning 7 figures in a single calendar year.
Yeah.
But if you can do that as an athlete, of course people are going to look and they're going to go, well, why can't you stop smoking weed?
Right.
That was a big deal with the Steelers, right? Yeah. They caught him in the city.
Le'Veon Bell
at the airport.
And
stay
Garrett
off
Blunt.
The weed,
right. Stephen A. Smith.
And so it's funny on the one end, like you're like, okay, dude, clearly you're an a-hole. You can't stop smoking weed. On the other end, you got to remember you're talking to a 22-year-old.
Exactly.
He just happens to be famous and rich.
Right.
You know, no one gives. Think of it this way. Think about rock stars. Same thing.
Oh, yeah.
The difference is they're rock stars.
Right. So they're allowed to do cocaine and smoke weed and smoke crack, whatever they want.
When I was at the height of my training, I said in the next life, I'm going to be a rock star. I'm not going to be.
I'm going to be Rick James.
I'm not going to be an athlete because being an athlete is like. Being an athlete is like Adam and Eve and Apple.
Mm-hmm.
You get this nice garden, you get all this stuff, and there's that apple. And that apple is drinking.
Yeah.
Heavy. Staying out all night partying with fans.
Yep.
People who want to buy you stuff. Girls who don't even care to if you learn their name.
Yeah.
And God, the person who gives you your athletic ability and all this talent.
Yep.
He goes, you can have anything in the garden. Just don't eat the apple. That's all you got to do. And you can stay. And what do you do? What's the first thing?
You want that apple.
Oh, my God.
There's carrots. There's pears. You could kill the animals if you figure out fire. And you eat that apple. You know, he's like, hey, man, that's it. You got to go. And then, so it's... I'm really looking forward to how that changes the athletic landscape in this country.
Sure.
Because at the end of the day, and here's the other thing too, when people argue back and they go, well, we're giving them scholarships. We're giving them scholarships. Of course that's great. And I'm like, have you seen what these guys major in?
Yeah.
Like, they're not.
Yeah, no.
I'm actually laughing.
I don't know
about
why
it.
They don't.
Right, they're not taking the education seriously.
Not only are they not majoring in anything useful, what they are studying, they're not taking it seriously. And on top of that, the school is more interested in the money.
Exactly.
So what are they going to do?
They're not going to flunk them out class.
Right. When's the last time you heard of somebody
Never.
Getting on academic probation?
Well, like, and he didn't play on Sunday or something.
Academic probation.
Right, right,
that doesn't
right.
happen. No. Now, if you can't do anything, you just taking up space. Yeah, right. gonna put you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how it is, man.
And the other thing is, like, when I was that age, like, I can't remember how much of a dumbass I was when I was that age. When I was that young, like, in my late teens, early 20s. And then imagine just having that massive microscope on you of millions of people watching you every moment, scoping in on everything you post on social media, all the comments. And then on top of that, give some young, you know, ignorant, cocky kid millions of dollars. That's going to fuck them up even worse mentally. You know what I mean?
It's going to ruin them.
Yeah.
Check this out. I learned, I would like to think at this point in my life, I'm above average at managing money. And I say above average because now my money does not just, I'm way past blowing it. but it doesn't just sit in my bank account either. I put it in a place where it can do a thing for me, right?
Right.
I'm not like up to investing in stocks.
Yeah.
But I try to use my money and let it go.
What do you do? You got real estate?
No. I guess it technically it's like I have Acorn, right? Acorn takes $25 out of my account and puts it someplace. And I checked it. I've been doing it for a year. I was like, wow, I think I made like $40 off of this. It's not a lot.
Yeah.
But it beat inflation. So,
yeah.
So it was kind of cool, right?
That is cool.
So I'm above average.
Hell yeah.
When I was 18, my dad died. When he died, his life insurance gave me $55,000.
What?
I didn't even, and it gave me, not my mom, the whole for me, it gave me because I was an adult at 18. In 18 months, I was overdrawing the account and sleeping on my aunt's floor. And dude, when I look at, like, what did I have to show for it? It's not like I had I bought myself a chain and some stupid clothes, a lot of fast food. I didn't even drink that. Because I was in college, I was drinking other people's alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was buying fast food, man, the Chinese food place. They knew me by first name, Domino's, all that good stuff. I had no concept of, like, what made sense to buy and what did not make sense to buy and where to put money. Yeah. And so that's me from the type of environment that a lot of these guys are from.
Yep.
And I got all relative to like an NFL contract was $55K and I couldn't even hold on to it for 18 months. I mean, that's what happened.
God damn.
Look, it's funny in retrospect.
What a lesson. That was an expensive lesson in money management. Damn.
In retrospect, hilarious. Like, oh man, look at 18-year-old me. I can't figure it out.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I remember when I was 19, I was living on my aunt's floor, sleeping on it because she already had a bunch of people living with her. I wasn't going back home at all, not because of shame or anything.
Whose floor did you say you were living on?
My aunt's.
Your aunt, okay.
My aunt's floor.
You weren't getting along with your mom or what?
Oh, no, no. We weren't. I mean, that's another story in itself why we weren't getting along. And we can touch on that, too, because that's probably some very powerful lessons about forgiveness in there.
Yeah.
But when I'm doing that and I need to eat during the day, during the evening, I would just go over to this girl's house I was dating. I mastered the art of being a hobo sexual.
That's what he is. He's a homosexual.
You get your girlfriend or your girlfriend's parents to feed you. You're gonna be all right if you get run that game. But I imagine. But during the day, I had to eat something. I had a list of CVS's and Rite Aids. I would go in and I figured out how to slide some Pringles. That's what I used to take. I used to steal Pringles.
Uh-huh.
And some. I think it was like Faygo Pop, right? And I would put that in my pocket, and that's what I would eat during that day.
Damn.
And I was really good at it. I knew the camera angles, everything, man. And yeah, you got to survive. It was either that or not eat.
Right.
Now that I'm like, what's funny, now I'm real big into intermittent fasting.
You could have just fasted the whole time.
Just fasted before, you know. I remember one day my friend of mine was like, yo, is that homeless? Because I was like, wearing the same thing for days, and the facial hair I had at 19 was popping out, man. I looked rough. But lessons you learn.
Yeah.
Hard lessons, fun lessons, a thing I will never do again. Not only will I never do it again, but I'll never have a relationship with my children, you know, when I have them where they don't think they can come home and they don't feel comfortable. Because that's just a rough time. My mom, you know, I wrote about this to my email list.
Mm-hmm.
I just told them that story, and she was like, I don't know why you wouldn't come home. And I'm like, yes, you do. And it's crazy. I had a lot of issues with my mom. Some of them was just, you know, my personality and why it happened. But and how it happened, you know, you clash with another personality. But a lot of it is so my mom was not mature at all. Emotionally, mentally, I think. I mean, physically, she was an adult and had me, so by definition, right, mature there. But I'll never forget when I was 11. The 11 years old is when I realized I was going to have to take care of myself, because she gets drunk and gets into a fight with this woman in the street, and I remember standing between her and the door saying, don't go outside. Like, just stay in here. She doesn't listen and goes and gets arrested, and we have to deal with that. And at that point, I was like,
she'd have gotten arrested.
Yeah.
She beat the lady's ass or what?
Oh, yeah. And then in retaliation, we woke up to all this garbage dumped on our porch. It was ridiculous.
Oh, my God.
And then we had to do it with the, you know, and then we had to do it with her kids, you know, trying to fight us. It was stupid, man.
Oh, my God.
But, like, I remember going, this is the, I was even at 11, I had enough wherewithal to understand what the dynamic between a parent and a child should be. And I said, you and your lack of discipline, you abandon us. And that's what I felt. And then that was the tipping, not the tipping point, but that was really the start of it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize how badly, how poorly behind, how far behind I was until I got to high school. And I had the really fortune, the fortune of just, we living in something called a magnet system. I don't know if they have something like that here, but if you apply and you meet the criteria, you can go to any high school that is not your region's high school that will feed you in within the city. And I had enough sense to know I cannot continue to go to school in this area, because I'll either end up becoming a kingpin or a killer. But no situation is going to turn out well for me if I continue going here.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to go to this other school. And for the first time, it was the first time I'd ever been in a home where, like, a husband and wife lived and raised kids. And they had a house, and it was out the projects. I mean, I was like, I was floored. And what happened is that over time, watching how my mom continued to behave, and the options that I was given, or I felt like I didn't get, and it's true, I didn't get a lot of options, and nothing. I mean, literally nothing.
Yeah,
I think about that I was exposed to. I mean, we always had like food for the most part, right? But never the ability to explore anything besides, you know, go to school, come back, go to school, come back. I was like, this is messed up, and I just got angrier and angrier, and then I thought about a lot of other stuff too. and where I felt like the ball was dropped. You know, some people that we were around growing up, like one of the articles I was talking to you about, like being raised by crackheads, that really. Well, you know, she wasn't a crackhead, but we were babysat by crackheads and around them and everything.
You said, you mentioned to me that you knew what crack smoke smelt like and you were like sick of it or something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you see these things and you don't think anything of them until you see how it could and should be.
Right.
Because when I was there, I was just like, okay, everybody's messed up. Mm-hmm. Whatever, right? Everyone, you have to fight all the time, right? And I felt like, because I had a friend where I got to see like what his mom did, you know, getting out. And working hard. And it just, it made me so angry one day to think about a lot of the abuse that I ended up suffering and dealing with. And so I said, there's no way I'm going to go back. I'm not going to get along there. We have a very different way of seeing things. I have a very big, I'm really good about dealing with the future, or at least better and continue to try and get better. And she isn't very much instant gratification. Very much, I'm very emotional. So I left and I spent time being very angry. And then one day I figured out, and it was affecting how I would deal with her when I saw her.
So you went like on your own, you moved away and.
Oh yeah. You know, okay. since I was 18, I moved home one time because I needed to go home. And it was a rock bottom point that like we talked about.
Yeah.
And it only lasted 4 months because right around month three, I was, or maybe month two, I was like, this is a problem. I will suffer out there. I'm going to suffer no matter what, basically, is what I thought. I said, well, let's suffer in a way to hopefully build some character and doesn't have me think about doing something crazy. Mm. But I got tired of being angry. And it wasn't consistent with the way my kind of philosophy about the world was developing, which is very much responsibility for how you feel and your environment and how you think about things. So I was like, I started to dive into forgiveness and forgiveness. And now it is very much, if you want to talk about like my spiritual system,
yeah.
It's all based on forgiveness.
Okay.
The book, A Course in Miracles, whenever people ask me like, oh, what book should I read? What's your book recommendation? Yeah. I have three books. The Tao of Jeet Kune Do by Bruce Lee for your body, The Art of Learning for your mind, and A Course in Miracles for your heart.
Course in Miracles?
Mm-hmm. The Course in Miracles. And the whole premise, I won't get into the whole premise, it's kind of kooky. But the basic idea is that forgiveness is the only way you can ever be at peace.
Right.
And but forgiveness is an act. It's not a thing you just, well, I'm going to be forgiven. Nope. No, you have to work at it, and there's a way to work at it. And it really much, very much influenced how I was able to work through a lot of problems. How, like, now when I look back at some of my behavior when I was drinking, how that affected things. Mm. And because when you stop drinking and you look back at yourself when you're sober, you go, holy hell, that guy was a problem. And you feel bad. You feel bad about the way you talked, the way you treated, some of the things you did, the risk you took, the lives you put in danger, the people you annoyed, the friendships you strained, all of that. You feel bad about all of it. And I don't have those moments that much anymore, but when I first stopped drinking, I would have a lot of them.
Okay.
But I dealt with them by forgiveness. I had to learn to forgive myself. I always say you got to forgive three things to be at peace. You got to forgive yourself. You got to forgive the world. And you got to forgive the people who wronged you. It's easy to complain that the world is one way. You know.
I understand what you say about people that wronged you. But what do you mean about forgiving yourself? Like, what do you mean by that?
Okay. So I think a lot of times we feel guilty. This is my idea about guilt, and I may or may not have got this from the book.
Right. Like, I didn't go to the gym today. I feel guilty about that, or I went out and got fucked up last night.
Now, I think that's a general state of disappointment. But when I talk about guilt, I think we feel guilty about a thing that when we've done something, and we think we got away with it. We think we got the benefit without paying the cost.
Got it.
Right? It's why, you know, they talk about like people who turn themselves in for crimes. They do it because I really think there's a part of the population, and probably a significant part, it might be part of being human, that we don't do well when, well, like we know that equality is kind of an illusion, and we know that we do know that fairness is not. I think intuitively and internally, we know that for X, there should be some kind of minus X-ish
response.
And if you get the X, you feel guilty. Mm-hmm. If you you want to talk about even at the, I don't think you feel guilty so much for missing the gym as you do for not having your physique immediately go to shit, right? Like whenever you miss the gym and you immediately got, you know, you put on 10 pounds and your guts are hanging out, you're going to feel like, okay, that's what was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Right? But if that doesn't, then you feel bad.
Mm.
And then it keeps going and you're like, oh man, well, I know. And then eventually you either start going to the gym or you accept the new state of things.
Right.
Because your mind can't reconcile. Now, on the flip side, you would know something's really wrong. If you were pounding it out every day in the gym, but nothing was happening, there was no muscle. And that's another issue, right?
Right.
But the whole guilt thing comes when we think we've done something wrong and we have not, or we think we got some benefit.
Without putting in the work to get it.
Without putting in the work. Yeah. Or we acquired it in a
immoral way.
In a moral way. Right. And I don't like the word immoral. Something more quantitative. We acquired it in a way where the other people didn't know that they had to pay for it.
Right, okay.
Which is why lying makes us feel guilty. We got away with it. We didn't have to deal with the conflict. But now the other person kind of has to bear the weight of the cost.
Somebody else suffered.
Right, they have to pay. And so you forgive yourself. Like for me, well, he's a perfect example in my life. I think about all the times I drove drunk. No one died, sure. But the risk was there. And I'm a really big person about risk. Maybe if I was had a more deterministic mindset and I didn't think about the probabilities, maybe it didn't bother me. But I'm very aware of the probability. I talk about it all the time. I mean, I stopped drinking before the law of large numbers caught up with me. Which is the whole idea, the more you commit, the more times you flip a coin, right?
Yeah.
The closer it should get to one half, which is what we expect. You know, half the time heads tail. But if you flip it 10 times, it could be, like, you could realistically get 10 heads in a row, right? But the larger the number of trials gets, the closer you trend to what the expected average should be, right? So.
Like blackjack.
Right. You can. That's why the casino always wins.
Yeah, that's right.
Always wins, right?
That's right.
So
that's true.
If I think about this and I go, well, I beat the law of large numbers, right? That or I stop playing before the law of large numbers beats me is a better way to look at it. And that makes me feel guilty because there are some people, I talk to some guys, they got 4 DUIs. And I'm like,
I know.
How you get 4, man? Fuck. Shit, I've been pulled over 4 times and got out of it. You got 4? How'd that happen? Right?
And I drink 10 times more than you do.
Exactly. All it is the coin land in some way. And then when you look at it that way, you can feel bad. You know? Or are you steal something and no one realizes, everyone's pointing the blame or somebody else doesn't and they take the cost and you're aware of it. It's going to make you feel guilty.
So how do you forgive yourself for something like that?
I think the first thing you have to do is, one, it's going to be maybe not what you expected. First thing you got to do is realize that it's in the past. I think we hold grudges and we have difficulty forgiving when we think, well, because we think that our emotions are going to somehow change. If we get angry enough or sad enough, the causality will be reversed and we can go and make it right.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen. Right. That's why we think that's why we think revenge is going to balance the scale.
Right.
But then you can get your revenge. You can go, huh? Well, that didn't undo it. And I still feel like shit. And on top of that, I feel even worse now that I did something to somebody and affected a bunch of other lives who had nothing to do with it. That's how it goes, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first step, though, is to just understand it's in the past and there's nothing you can do about it. At the same time, you can own that you had something to do with it. And the third way is to remember. And this is the hardest thing for most people. This is the hard step that a lot of people, they follow me on the first one, they follow me on the second one, the third one is where they go, I'm not sure, man, you sound like you're on crack. The third step is you have to remember that no matter what, you did the thing and the other person did the thing or to you, or you did the thing because you were chasing what you believed was the best way to get a feeling. You thought it was the best way to feel fine. The other person thought it was the best way to alleviate something. And that's how you can be forgiven. That's how you can forgive someone else. Because look, if someone, I think about the worst thing that happened to me, it's been a long time someone did something foul to me. let's say like my girlfriend cheated on me or something.
Okay.
The first response is to be angry, is to hold a grudge, to want to do something bad. But I have to forgive her. And remember, forgiveness, I always have to say this, forgiveness doesn't substitute justice. I still got to break up with her, right?
Yeah.
And if someone kills my family, look, man, they still got to go to jail. Forgiveness is to keep me from dealing with that emotional burden and perhaps doing something destructive to myself because I think I can fix it. Right, that's what forgiveness is. So with that caveat out the way, I have to look at that. Going back to the girlfriend cheating example, or even a family killing example,
somebody killing a family member of yours. Yeah. That's a relevant thing in the media today. That just happened.
But they did it because they thought that it was going to bring them closer to peace for one way or the other. And in doing so, their actions are no different than my actions. And so I can take that and emotionally wrap my mind around it. That does not excuse the action. That does not mean I'm going to be cool with them. That doesn't mean any of that. You forgive a person so you don't carry that emotional burden yourself.
So you don't have to suffer.
Right. That's it. Perfect. Right? Because that's the idea. No one suffers but you when you hold a grudge. Exactly. Right? What is that old saying? It's like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die or something like that. That is so spot on. And if you get that, then you can easily forgive. Like that's but that's the hard part. That is the hardest step for many people to
Yeah. Trigger. That's strong, man. That's really strong. I think that's important for a lot of people to understand. Be able to understand that, to experience. You got to experience things like that where people really fuck you over or where you fuck somebody else over. You know what I mean? Where two people can come together and forgive each other or...
And I think, like, you know, what you said is another part, I think, of development. It'd be nice. I think we all would like to fashion ourselves as the hero in our story. We go through life and the whole time we are the only people who suffer wrong. We never do any wrong. It's not true. And owning that, I think, brings you a lot of peace because it forces you to take a process that you normally extend to other people, other things, forgiveness, and it forces you to apply it to yourself. Mm-hmm. I talked to a friend of mine that had dealt with some trauma, a female. This is important for the story. Dealt with some trauma, and she had trouble. She could forgive her attacker. She had trouble, so much trouble forgiving herself. She thought, okay, if I hadn't said this or did this or been in that position, this would not have happened. If I had been stronger, if I had resisted, this would not have happened. Mm. And in her mind, she can wrap herself around the idea that a person is evil and victimized, and she can forgive that. Your own hangups will determine what you can or cannot forgive when you have trouble. Because she can't wrap her mind around the idea that she made a mistake. Mm. She just made an error in judgment. She missed the bad guy. Mm. It happens. People have a hard time forgiving themselves. I think they have a way harder time forgiving themselves than they do other people. I really believe that a person can forgive the killer. Let's say someone killed the kid.
Yeah. Or something. Right.
This is an extreme. But I think that people would have a harder time forgiving themselves for allowing it to happen. And I don't even like using the verb allow, but I think that's the best word I have to describe that kind of action, right? For letting it happen, allowing it to happen, than they would for somebody taking advantage and being and exacting such a cruel action on them.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine something that extreme, someone killing someone really close to you and feeling that hatred towards that person nonstop every day. I mean, it's
exhausting. It demolishes you.
It would, you know?
And
but it's also extremely hard to get over that wall to be able just to let go.
Yeah, and I never say it should be easy, But
sometimes people don't think about it that way. They think they just do whatever is instant gratification.
Not only that, but they can't see a reason. You know, right. People, you have to take your inner peace and your wellness so right. seriously.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's just what it comes down to is if you follow it logically, you end up in the same place as you would if you follow it emotionally or rationally, I guess. If you follow it rationally, you'll end up in the same place you will if you follow it emotionally, mm-hmm. which is the other person does not experience what you continue to beat yourself up for. So you have to do something about that. And the premise that I follow is what you do about that is forgiveness. And forgiveness is not a substitute for justice. Justice right. still has to be done. I'm a big believer in that. I'm the guy that's going to be swinging the axe and taking your head off, telling you, look, man, it's okay. I really don't feel anything. Hey, man, why you cut my head off? No, 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 that's not for you.
That's for me. Right.
I don't feel anything. I just want you to know I forgive you.
You're forgiven.
Yeah.
But you're still dead.
but you still got to go, man. Like, that kind of thing. And people don't get that. And that's hard for people to reconcile, too, is that you can exact the punishment. You can protect yourself, but you can still forgive.
I like that. So, I really like that.
And I think it's a very, very strong and deliberate way to live. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why people resist it, because it's very deliberate.
Yeah, for sure. Well, cool, man. I read on your Twitter that you have some links to some books that you've written on your Twitter, or are they on your website?
Yeah, website and Twitter.
Okay, yeah. I saw, and you got like 100,000 something followers on Twitter, dude. You're blowing up, man.
Yeah, people keep finding me. I wonder if they're following me now because they see so many other people.
yeah, right. Like, is that what happens when you get so many that it snowballs like that? People just like.
It's not so much that it snowballs. I think it grows exponentially. I was going to say models after E, but like that's just the math, not nerd of me. But in other words, you know, each one follower can get two people to follow, and each of those people can get two, so it goes one, two, four. I think
you got some big followers though.
Yeah, that too.
I noticed you have Rick Rubin following you.
Yeah, you know, someone messaged me. I was like, yo. Did you know Rick Rubin follows you? And I said, no, let me look up who that, because I mean, I'm not.
You didn't even know who he was?
No.
Oh, man.
But once I found out, I took a screenshot of it and put it on my Facebook.
That's wild.
And they were like, that's crazy.
That's really cool.
All the members of the Peterson Follow family.
Yeah.
Donald Trump Jr., Scott Adams.
Donald Trump Jr. follows you?
Yeah.
Holy shit. Wow.
Now, I wish I could tell people, I know exactly why these people like me.
Mm.
I got no idea, right? I can't because I'm not transmitting what I think is a better than winning personality via these tweets. But what I am putting out is, you know, my experience and I think I'm authentic. I'm not false. So these people, when they follow me, I just go, cool, man. Like a lot of times, I wish there was a way to see how many like people with a blue check mark follow me. Because every now and then, because here's what Twitter does. Whenever someone with a blue check mark or a high follower count follows you or interacts with you, forget follow, interacts with you, whether they like your tweet or retweet it, you get force notified.
Yeah.
All right. And so I'll get a notification. I'm like, who is this person? And then I look and I go, wow, that's cool, man. Hell, it's crazy. All these people follow me.
Yeah.
What's his name? David Ayer follows me. And if you don't know who that is, right? Look, man, you're not supposed to know how old you are.
Right, right.
He's the guy who wrote and directed Training Day.
Really?
Yeah. The awesome guy. And he actually, he bought my, well, he messed with me a few times. One, when he bought my book about sobriety, because he talked about, I guess he had the same issues.
Okay.
And bought it and resume. And he also goes, oh, man, no wonder why, like, you have the same birthday. I was like, okay.
No shit.
So he wished me happy birthday on my birthday. I was like, oh, man, cool, thanks.
That's awesome.
That's crazy, man.
So, yeah, you know, we live in this world where if you have, I think, a valuable thing to say and a valuable
message people can relate to.
Yeah. And you know, and now I think a lot of it too is I think I'm a great communicator, right? You know, I try, you know, better than average, average, moderate, right? No, I think I'm a great communicator and a great writer. And I think that really helps with a lot of people connect and follow me and retweet my stuff and find me. And then I'm able to like take that and put it in other platforms and get them on my list and my website and all that. But the whole idea, the whole point of me bringing that up is I think that if you have something to say and you work on how you say it, we live in a great world where you can share that and connect with other like-minded people. I'm only in Florida because of the Twitter connections I made, right?
Right.
So, and right. So those are the two parts. And then the third part is what I was saying at the beginning. If you live life, if you have something valuable to say and give and experience, and it ain't got to be something crazy, you know, people, here's what blow your mind, right? We talked about the boxing and to many people, that would be that thing.
Yeah.
Makes you famous.
Right.
But let me tell you something. When I lost my fight and effectively disappeared from that level of notoriety, I only had 7,000 followers.
Wow. At the peak of your boxing? Wow.
This has all been done since then via my writing, via what I say, my speaking, and everything I do.
Way.
And so that lets me know, right? You want to talk about some real time feedback? Right. What should you do with your life? That lets me know that I have something unique to offer. People see something unique and it makes, and I would be foolish to not take advantage of it. This is the decision I made my final year of school when I was 30, 33, right? Mm-hmm. When I said, you know, I don't have the personality to work in a lab. Or rather, it was more, I don't have the personality to be behind the scenes. Very much, you know, MBTI, whether you think it's trash or not. My MBTI is ENTJ, and I fit that to a T, both positive and negative.
You're what?
ENTJ, extroverted, intuitive. Man, I can't even remember all of it. Judgment.
Okay.
But yeah, some people know what it is, some people won't, right?
Okay.
But very much extroverted, very much interested in interacting with people. And so all of the jobs I saw that my career path was taking me down, they were not that. And so I was like, all right, whatever, not interested. And then that explains why I love the teaching. I get in front to talk and communicate with people. I mean, I really love tutoring. I continued it longer than I had to. Like, it started as a thing I needed to do for money, and it ended with me going, well, I really like this, but at this point, it costs more of my money and time to go than it's worth. Like, it very much was a side thing that I was having fun with doing. And I find this communication, I get so much out of it. There's something about sitting here
connecting with people
and connecting. And then however my brain works, I think I'm very good at explaining things. And all these things really come together, and I say, half joking, 40% joking, half 40%. The Twitter was really made for people like me that I can sit and write. And then on top of that, I can start a blog. And I, you know, it's funny. I've gone back over my writing and I see how I've gotten better and better and better progressively.
Yeah.
Better able to express the same idea with fewer words. My word economy's improved. My word choices improved. And I continue to sharpen it up because that's what I love to do. People are like, man, why don't you start a YouTube channel? I'm like, yeah, but then I got to do a YouTube channel. Like, not interested. I want to write. I want to write. I want to communicate with that method, you know.
That's cool.
Have a good time.
Yeah, there's a lot. People are different in the way they like to communicate on social media. Like Instagram and Twitter are so different.
Yeah.
Like, there's some people who just, like, love posting pictures and being vague about things. And there's people who love just all day fucking tweet, talking about things, like, what they feel, what they, like, a cool quote they saw.
Right.
I think it's it's interesting to be able to do both. I mean, you got to be able to, because, like, if you're a visual thinker or a visual communicator versus...
And it's a great challenge because now the next thing I'm like, okay, I'm doing well on Twitter.
Yeah.
Let me try Instagram out, right? Yeah, but pretty much I'm trying to avoid a thing that is going to require a huge investment of my time, like putting together a channel. So I was like, let me do Instagram. Mm. And I'm having a lot of fun with that. I passed 10K, so now I can send people back to my website.
Oh, nice.
Via my stories. But I'm having a lot of fun with that. But what it's taught me is that words do one thing, pictures do another thing. Mm-hmm. And if you want to, if you can, the more things you can do, the more options you have. Yeah. And if you are, and I can really figure out, I can learn the whole, because look, the whole hashtag system, figured it out. Well, I didn't figure it out, but like realize it's nothing more than an SEO. The SEO I did just applied to a thing. You know, the more followers you have, the more hashtags you can rank, or rather, hashtags have a certain number of posts attached to them. And the more followers you have, the more likely you are to rank if you put something in that hashtag. Mm-hmm. And each post has a finite amount of like outlink energy based on outlink energy. That's outlink points. You know, like you can only put so many links on a website before each individual link loses its ability to be a follow link and get you SEO points. Mm-hmm. Same idea with IG, right? So really understanding this, right? It becomes more deliberate. I'm not just hashtagging for, oh, I think this is cool. Hashtag, you know, goals. Hashtag this.
Right. Some people have a freaking 100,000 hashtags on their posts.
Right. So I goes, oh, no, let's pick something a little smaller where I can get on front page of that based on the things that people are following. And it turns into a really fun game. These games of connection are really interesting to me.
Do you, for Instagram, do you screenshot your tweets and post them on Instagram?
I used to.
That's a hack, dude. That works good for me, at least.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe I should get back to it. I don't know.
Yeah, you got to do that, man. The screenshots from Twitter to Instagram. That's.
You know what I've been doing? I've been sending them to my stories and then. But I think I'll probably get some more out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Because on the one end, you talk to these pros who run these agencies. Well, I'm learning when someone says they run an agency.
Yeah.
Look, well, here's the biggest sign for me. If you tell me you run an agency and your Twitter account is smaller than mine, then I can't, like I can't listen to you. I do a lot of stuff helping people grow their Twitter. And I can do it because there's just not going to be many people who have more followers than me, right? Mm-hmm. Even if I was full of shit, which I'm not, but even if I was, they're going to look at my follower count and the ratios.
I was like, okay.
They're going to we got it. We have to at least listen to this guy, right?
Yeah.
they can't just write me off, but I get guys write me. They're going, you know, here's the thing, you know, and we do this and we do that and we help these accounts. And I look and I go, yeah, man, but you got like 900 followers, bro. Like, what? How are you gonna help me get to where I'm trying to go? Now, I'm working with one group now, and the people who reached out to me, okay, I see you've done the thing that you say that you can do for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that you walk the
walk.
Yeah, and so I'm in. You know,
yeah.
So we'll see how it goes.
Hell yeah, man. Well, cool. I think we're about to hit your time limit here. We're about an hour and a half in.
Awesome, man. This is fun.
Yeah. Where can people find your stuff? Where can they watch your videos, read your books?
Oh, my videos. That's all over YouTube. But read my books. You know, just put my name, Ed Lattimore, on Amazon, and you'll see them. It was really smart about it. Or rather, I'm really fortunate that I have the name Ed Lattimore, and no one beat me to it. I feel bad for the guy who comes up next who wants to use Ed Lattimore, because my website is edlattimore.com.
Nice.
My Instagram is Ed Lattimore. My Twitter is Ed Lattimore.
No problem.
Facebook
getting your
page is Ed Lattimore. And very simple, too, right? The only trouble is that, like, the way Lattimore is pronounced, versus how it's spelled, some people put two T's in there. Nope. I'm one T, Ed Lattimore. And
edlattimore.com.
Edlattimore.com, Ed Lattimore Instagram, Ed Lattimore on Twitter.
Hell yeah, man. Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for coming out here and sharing your knowledge and your wisdom and your stories. It's been fun.
I really appreciate this, man. Thank you guys.
It was a pleasure.
Yes, sir.